Welcome to the second Year of Wonders podcast. Before we get going, just a few things that came up after the first podcast. Firstly, Anna is actually introduced as a narrator on the second page. So what I was saying before in the first podcast about the whole mystery of who this narrator is, actually, yes, she is introduced fairly early on. Cromwell, who took over after Charles I was executed, his first name was Oliver and not Thomas. I thought I might have been able to get away with saying that his son was called Thomas, but no, his son's name was Richard. So Oliver Cromwell was the head of the state, as it were, after the death of Charles I and before Charles II came back in 1660 to take over the throne again. So apologies for those two fairly fundamental errors. And I'll try and make sure that stuff like that doesn't happen again. I asked my students to look up a few things. One of them was to find out what a Timothy plant was. Now, that turns out to be a plant that's fairly common in North America and parts of Europe and used to feed cattle. Okay, so when that comes up in the opening kind of chapter, the scene-setting chapter, that's what a Timothy plant is. Black Death was another name for the plague. That was a question that came up in class. And the plague that actually broke out during Anna's time was bubonic. There are other forms of plague. Pneumonic is one of them. But the plague that's actually sort of central to the plot here is actually a bubonic plague. The interregnum is the name for the period of time in which there was no crowned royal on the throne. So that was the time that Oliver Cromwell was actually on in charge of things. And if you're kind of curious about a more sort of modern reference to Oliver Cromwell, there's a really good song by Elvis Costello called Oliver's Army, which actually triggered the "Oh God, I got it wrong" train of thought. So yeah. All right, well, let's get started on the first chapter. This is where Anna actually goes back to the spring of 1665, and the title of the chapter is called Ring of Roses. And when you're looking at it, the titles of the chapters are used really deliberately. So what you might want to do is think about what Brooks was intending with the chapter title here. And initially, it seems like a really lovely connotation. Ring of roses, you've got the idea of blooming, beauty. And given that Anna's quite a visual narrator, it's something that does kind of suggest good things. But if you've done some research into the bubonic plague, you'll know that one of the first signs of plague is actually these blooming of ring-like, petal-like kind of shapes on the skin. So while it might suggest something positive, it actually is signaling to us as a modern audience that something really wrong is kind of going to get underway soon. George Vickers is introduced pretty early on, right in the opening paragraph, actually, in that first chapter. And there is a sense that Anna has quite a clear sense of self in terms of her personal worth and her self-protection. It's worth remembering, though, that she's narrating this with hindsight. So all of these things that she's telling us about, she's older than she was when it actually happened. So there's an overlay of subjectivity that kind of comes through. It's interesting that George Vickers actually fits in really well into Anna's household. Well, probably one of the things you might want to think about, though, is the idea of a different sense of time. She's 18. People didn't really live as long as they do now, although there are older people in the village of Eam. But by the end of the week, she kind of makes a comment along the lines of, you know, he's fitted in really well. He's kind of taken to the boys. They've taken to him. She's gotten really comfortable with having him as a lodger. Sam has actually died earlier in the year, and Anna, as an 18-year-old, you know, is self-sufficient, but also looking for, I mean, you know, she's 18, she's pretty much your age. And she's lived in a really abusive household. She escaped when she was 15, married Sam. So she's lived a lifetime by the time she's gotten to this point. Here's George Vickers, the tales that he gives Anna, or sort of tells her about the different ports in terms of, you know, shipping and places that he's heard of and where fabrics come from and that kind of thing, give us, the modern audience, a sense of how the plague might have actually travelled. But Anna's actually captivated by the whole idea of foreign places. And again, that's an element of foreshadowing of where she herself is actually going to end up. Again, it's something with the benefit of hindsight. She's able to give us this clue without revealing the actual reality of her situation a year later. I think something worth noting also is the way that she compares Mr. Vickers, as she calls him at this point, to Sam, and how Sam was very much a simple kind of guy who was a hardworking, plain, loving kind of husband to her. And in comparison, George Vickers seems very exotic and very well travelled. On page 26, she says, "Mr. Vickers seemed never to have been confined at all. When he entered our village, he brought the wide world with him." And then she goes on a little bit to say, "He could tell such tales of Barbary seamen who wrapped their copper-coloured faces in turbans of rich indigo, of a Mussulman merchant who kept four wives all veiled so that each moved about with just one eye peeking from her shroud." I do really like the way that he compares the physical environment of London to a person. And when he says on page 27, "The city is like a corpulent man trying to fit himself into the jerkin he wore as a boy. So many have moved there looking for work that souls are heaped up to live 10 and 12 to a room no larger than the one we sit in. Poor souls have tried to add on to their dwellings and garner space as they can, so that the misshapen parts of buildings lean out across the alleyways and teeter high atop decaying roofs that you wonder can hold the weight. The gutters and spouts are fixed on anyhow, so that even long after rain has passed, the wet drips down upon you to leave you always clammy damp." And what he's doing there is actually giving us a description of London, but also the conditions in which the plague was allowed to flourish, because people were so cramped up in that physical environment. The plague spread really quickly and really didn't have to try very hard to infect the 100,000 people or so that died during that time. Anna shows her tolerance and her ability to see before she judges. Again, keep in mind that this is with the benefit of hindsight, and also the influence of Eleanor as well, something that she later references when Eleanor tells her about her own past. It's possible that when Anna says that, you know, she left the cottage, the Gowdy's cottage, trying to be the woman that Eleanor wanted her to be, it's almost like we see this woman that Eleanor wanted her to be emerging in this chapter here. One of the questions that came up in class today was how Anna was actually able to become so educated so quickly. And given that she didn't learn to read until she was quite old, she has a remarkable ability to gather knowledge. And on the bottom of page 28, she said, "I longed to learn about the places and the people that I could never hope to see. And now I feared I would appear such a prude to Mr. Vickers that he would no longer speak freely with me." So, again, she's sort of showing her open-mindedness and also her thirst, as it were, to gather this knowledge and to learn as much about the world around her as possible. Could I just apologise for the amount of times that I seem to be saying, I'm not quite sure why that is the case. I'm probably so used to actually being in a classroom and having an interaction with students that I'm filling the gaps where the conversation would normally be with the word and it's really annoying, and I'm really sorry about that. So I will try to actually not do that as much. Okay. Right. On page 29, That wasn't quite an arm. That was just page 29. Oh, damn. Okay. There is a defense of Anna's desire for knowledge when she, when it says something along the lines of, yes, there it is, top paragraph. I told him then that I had had it directly from our rector, that knowledge itself is not evil. It is only to the use which one puts it that may imperil the soul. And I think that's kind of interesting when you consider Anna, and definitely when you consider the Gaudis later on and how the village people abuse the worth of the knowledge of the Gaudis. George Vickers does have good intentions, just moving along. He is actually quite an honourable man, and his present of address that he makes for her in the golden green, the colour of sunlight dappled leaves of modest style but well cut and flattering, is a really lovely personal gift. It's also a really intimate sort of gift for her as well, something that indicates that he's actually been watching her very carefully and also indicates his skill as a tailor. Her maternal instincts when, she does kind of find it a bit intimate that he gives her this dress, and also perhaps when he comes across her looking at the dress too, it's interesting that it's a point in time in which their relationship turns a corner, and her reaction to the dress is really lovely actually, and also gives the reader an idea of where the relationship is going to go. So she takes off her dirty underclothes, she puts the dress on. George Vickers walks in and sees her and says to her, "Mistress, I would make you a dozen such gowns to display your beauty." Then the playful tone left his voice and dropped, becoming husky. "I would you might think me worthy to provide for you in all matters." He crossed the room and placed his hand on my waist, drew me gently towards him and kissed me. I will not say that I know what would have happened then if his skin, when it brushed mine, had not been so hot that I pulled back. And unfortunately, it's not hot for all the reasons that she wants it to be. It's more that he's got the temperature, and this is the point at which George Vickers is pretty much starting to go downhill, although the Ring of Roses hasn't quite bloomed on his skin. He's definitely got one of the first signs of bubonic plague, which is the fever. Her maternal instincts definitely come to the fore with this when she tells him that I will give you a cooling draught to take up with you. We will speak again of these things on the morrow when you're restored. So she fully expects that this is just a small hiccup and that things obviously will move on the next day. Okay, so then she actually gives us a bit more of an insight. On pages 32 and 33, there's a lovely kind of insight into her maternal relationship with her two boys, and a little bit more of an insight into her daily routine as well. So the fact that she gets up before the cock crows so as to accomplish my household chores before Mr. Vickers descended from his garret. And then she goes up to see the boys, and then comes back downstairs. She relays the fire, puts a big kettle to heat. Now keep in mind that everything's done like this. Obviously, 17th century. There's no electricity. You're working by candlelight, natural light, or nothing at all. And she also sort of describes the beautiful sense of the air with this really great sentence when she said, "And that morn the air was rich with summer's loamy fragrance. It was a morning fit for the contemplation of new beginnings." It definitely was the beginning, the contemplation of new beginnings, only it was the beginnings of something awful and not something really what she thought it was going to be. And so she then gives us an idea as to Sam's living and how miners work. And this is important because what this is doing is setting up the Mary Wickford episode later. And gives us the details in terms of the dish of lead and the kind of obligations and and how the village is kind of structured in terms of the mining there. And that's on page 34. Then we kind of move on a little bit. I'm kind of skipping around about that. All I want to do is kind of give you an overview of what's actually happening in the chapter. So it might be a little bit easier than kind of going back and rereading the whole chapter, if I can just kind of summarize it for you. Although working on the assumption that you have actually read the book and this is just to kind of remind you, okay? Her initial description of Eleanor on page 35 echoes the drive that's later seen in Michael. So when she says here, the frail body was paired with a sinewy mind capable of violent enthusiasms and possessed of a driving energy to make and do. So violent enthusiasms, what she means by that is passionate enthusiasm. So she throws herself wholeheartedly into everything, okay? She's not, her appearance and her personality and drive are two very different things. So she's trying to make sure that she gives us that very clear description at the start. The whole idea of when she says, sometimes it seemed as if the wrong soul had been placed inside that slight body, for she pushed herself to her limits and beyond and was often ill as a result. There was something in her that could not or would not see the distinctions that the world wished to make between the weak and strong, between men and women, labour and lord. Of course, what Anna doesn't know is Eleanor's desperate for penance. So her throwing herself wholeheartedly into all of these things is probably twofold. One is to make atonement for her previous sin that we don't know about yet. And the second thing is perhaps she's diverting energy that would have been put into her marriage into more external kind of things. So that's something to keep in mind. But obviously we don't know any of this yet, but it's interesting that we get a snapshot of Eleanor in this respect. So when Anna turns up at the rectory, even though they're kind of similar in age, okay, well, you know, slightly, the 6 or so years, but they're fairly similar in age, but Eleanor's quite maternal in her relationship with Anna. She's the teacher to Anna's student, and I think Anna picks up so much more from Eleanor than she realizes perhaps initially. And then later on, it's a very conscious kind of absorption of Eleanor's personality, her interests, her drive to kind of achieve and accomplish and heal. So on page 37, we know that Eleanor is the one that teaches Anna to read. We know that even though Anna's father is proud of his daughter's desire to learn, girls were not schooled. It wasn't necessarily seen as something that was a good thing, actually. Educating girls, if you kept them uneducated and ignorant, then you could definitely make them more reliant. They were definitely subservient. Church and state taught the subservience of women to the patriarchal dominance of men at the time. And Anna was very much the victim is probably too slight. Too harsh a word. She's very much a product of her time. So when somebody like Eleanor, who is an early feminist, actually, in that respect, comes along and takes Anna under her wing, Anna blooms very much like the roses that they and the garden that they tend together in the rectory. The herbal law idea is actually introduced by the Gowdies. Now, Mem and Annis Gowdy are the two local kind of wise women. Obviously, you had the surgeons who were, as far as Anna's concerned, the barbarians. The surgeon who operated on her mother when she was 4 used a thatcher's hook to get her mother to open up wide enough so that she could deliver the baby. And if you've not seen a thatcher's hook, at the end of this podcast, I want you to go and Google what a thatcher's hook looks like and then imagine a surgeon using that as a way of delivering a baby. And their practices at the time were barbaric. So a lot of villages, especially in rural areas, although not necessarily confined to just a rural area, would go to the local wise women who were generational women. They would pass down knowledge that was accumulated and learned to the next generation. So Mem was the older Gaudi, Annis was her niece, and it's one of those female kind of professions. But it was a very fine line that they needed to walk. So when Anna says, "I knew how easy it is for a woman to be turned witch with the common in the common mind," she is aware that you can be a wise woman until something kind of goes wrong, and then you get the blame for it. So the idea of superstitions and social need kind of collide, and it was a very kind of precarious path that these women walked. Annis Gaudi, I have a real liking for her. I think she's just one of those women that calls it like it is and isn't afraid of people and doesn't apologize for who she is. And she sets more of an example, I think, than Anna realizes. Anna sees her with a mixture of admiration and awe and a little bit of fear as well, because Annis is just out there and in your face. So on page 39, where it says here, "Though none now dared whisper witch against old Mem, there were some who still looked aslant at her young niece Annis, who lived with her and assisted at confinements and in the growing and drying and mixing of her brews." So to look aslant is to kind of look sideways at somebody. A confinement is when a woman is in the latter stages of pregnancy, sort of childbirth. So they go into confinement. It's sort of like a childbirth lockdown, as you were. We get an idea of Aphra. And even though Anna says she approached, this is Aphra approached Annis with a mixture of fear and awe and perhaps some envy, I think Anna shares the mixture of fear and awe, but I don't know that she really shares Afra's envy until she learns about Annis and George kind of hooking up. You know, is sort of that sort of temporary thing. Aphra is very superstitious, I think, and that kind of comes through, and the envy very much kind of comes through at the bottom of page 39, when she said, "You've seen the way the men, old and young, sniff around her as if she were a bitch in heat. You can call it physic all you like, but I think she's brewing up more than cordials in that croft of her." And so she doesn't know what the Gaudis are doing, but she's definitely not convinced that it's something that is altogether, you know, above board. So Anna's pretty switched on in terms of why she thinks Aphra treats Annis the way she does, when she says that she probed near the place where her ill will to Annis resided. And perhaps the envy comes from the fact that Annis is independent. She doesn't rely on a man. She doesn't need a man, unlike Aphra, who is reliant totally on Anna's father, who is just a creep, frankly. Okay, so then we kind of move on a little bit, and we go back to Anna's cottage, and George is really not doing too well at all, and we get the first sort of description of what it's like in terms of physical descriptions of the plague. So the top of page 43, "As I attempted to lift him to place the pillow, he cried out piteously, for the pain from that massive boil was intense. Then the purple thing burst all of a sudden open, slitting like a pea pod and issuing forth creamy pus all spotted through with shreds of dead flesh. The sickly sweet smell of apples was gone, replaced by a stench of weak old fish. I gagged as I made haste to swab the mess from the poor man's face and shoulder and staunch his seeping wound." And I know it's gross, but there's something kind of fascinatingly icky about the symptoms of the plague and the idea that you get the rotting apples coming through again. So this is like a recurring visual motif that Brooks uses. it keeps coming through. There's evidence that George had an idea of what actually was going on, that he knew what his illness was, when he says to Anna, "You've got to burn it all," basically. And this is something that kind of sets off, it's like a domino effect. From Anna's cottage, everything radiates outwards after he dies. And he does die. His mouth, on page 44, his mouth was all crusted with sores, and hourly I would dribble a little water on his lips and wipe them. He would look at me, his brow creasing with effort as he tried to express his thanks. So the whole idea that he just, it's not a painless death. It's a slow kind of agonizing death where the body's trying to purge itself of all the disease, basically, and it just kind of can't cope and clogs up and just shuts down. We see Michael, Mr. Montpellier, turn up in this chapter in his capacity as the local rector after George dies. And he says, when she says to him, "It's a hard thing," I said, "for a man to die amongst strangers with no family to mourn him." But interestingly, Anna does mourn George. I think she mourns not only the death of George, but also the death of the possibility of a relationship with him and a life and something new and exciting for her and the boys. Montpellier says to her, "You should console yourself in the joy that you and your sons were able to give him and the mercy that you especially have shown," which is kind of nice actually, and something that he attempts to do with the other villagers that die over and over and over. They just don't know it yet. So we are coming to the end of the podcast now, which I'm sure that you'll be incredibly grateful for. But I have two tasks that would be interesting for you to actually have a look at and do a bit of research on. The more kind of contextual information that you've got, the better you have, better chance you have of kind of grounding this in something that's concrete and your understanding kind of solidifies. The first thing I'd like you to do is have a look at the spread of the plague and see if you can find a map that actually charts the spread of it. Try the 17th century if you can, because that's, you know, the time of the actual plague outbreak that we're looking at. And if you can, try and get a map of Derbyshire and Eme, where actually, I mean, it does exist. So try and get a map so you can actually have a look and see where it actually lies. Also, just do a quick look up of plague symptoms and what the timeline was of the illness, because George Vickers did die fairly quickly, although there were some people that took quite a long time to die as well. So look at the average time that it took for the symptoms to develop, and also perhaps how it spread. Now, I know it was the rats, and I know that they went around and killed all the cats and dogs and thinking that it was their fault, but look at how it actually spread via the rats, via the fleas, okay? All right, so I think that's pretty much the end of this one. Remember, if you've got any questions or anything, please email me and let me know. Okay, so that pretty much ends the podcast, number two. If there's anything that you want me to clarify, something you didn't understand, things that you'd like to add to the podcast, let me know. And I will catch you next time. Thanks very much.